Well, I'm sure many of you listening at the moment have small children. Can you imagine one of your children at just 9 witnessing your mother getting into an argument with fellow workers over a cup of water and then your mother ending up in prison? Well, that's exactly what happened to Aisha Mashiq. She was just 9 when she saw her mum, Asya Bibi, have that situation happen to her. She got in an argument over a cup of water and she was accused by her co-workers of blasphemy, and as a result of that altercation has been on death row ever since. Now, the Supreme Court in Pakistan has been considering the appeal of Asya Bibi's case, and it's still not known if they will uphold the original ruling or set the mother of 5 free. Our next guest met Asya Bibi's husband and daughter in London at an event organised by his charity Aid to the Church in Need. On the line to tell us a little bit more about the case and his experience meeting Asya Bibi's family, we have John Pontifex, who's Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need. John, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, John, give us a little bit more of a background to the Asya Bibi case, about how she ended up in prison in the first place and how long she's been there.
Well, your description there of what happened to her was very, very accurate. One thing I could add is that, of course, she was accused of blasphemy, namely defaming the Prophet Muhammad, which, according to 295C of Pakistan's infamous blasphemy laws, is a crime punishable by death in the country. And as a result of that, Asya Bibi is on death row, or has been, since 2010, and the family have been fighting rigorously to protect her from this horrible outcome. She's been in solitary confinement all this time, and the family have not been able to physically get anywhere close to her. There's always a grill or whatever that separates them from her when they go to visit her in prison. And that's why so often we heard Aisham, the daughter who you mentioned earlier, say her greatest wish is to be able to hug her mother. The physical estrangement that they've suffered all this time has meant that the whole family, Asya, of course, and her family as well, have suffered a kind of living martyrdom since that fateful day in June 2009, when, of course, she was accused of blasphemy and went through this horrible ordeal.
When I think about Asya's daughter, and I know that you met her, I mean, she was 9 years old. Now she's a young woman. She's coming into adulthood now. Her mother has essentially been missing from her life for most of her childhood. Tell us a little bit about your meeting with the family.
Well, it was a very emotional encounter because for many of us, we thought it would be impossible to actually bring about this meeting. The visa regulations for people coming from Pakistan to the UK are very tough. And we, right up until the last minute practically, were uncertain whether this visa would come through. So you can imagine my feelings when I went to the airport at Heathrow here in London, and finally saw them come through in the arrivals lounge, and they had themselves already been through a long ordeal that day. They'd set off extraordinarily early. They are, of course, 5 hours ahead of us in Pakistan, and there we were meeting them in the evening. And I remember vividly so many moments that I had with the family. One of the most moving moments for me was at the end of one of our events. Actually, it was in Scotland, and Isham was tired. She wanted to basically go back to the hotel and rest. But she saw a picture of her mother, a little prayer card which had a picture of her mother. And absolutely unconsciously, it seemed, she just picked up this card and looked at the picture of her mother and kissed the picture. And it brought home the extent to which this is a personal loss, this is a personal tragedy, and that, you know, they've waited too long for justice, they've waited too long to be able to see their mother back with them at home again, and the sense is that when will this ordeal end?
So what is the situation now at the moment? Is there reason to believe that there could be a decision made through the Supreme Court soon, John?
Well, there is, and the every expectation that the Supreme Court will announce its decision imminently. It was on October the 8th that the final hearing took place in the Supreme Court. And here we are on the 23rd of October with the court yet to announce its decision. And almost every day there is the faint possibility that today would be the day when they would actually announce that decision. And the question has to be asked, well, why aren't they announcing it? And that question is almost inevitably linked to the mobs, many of whom have amassed outside the Supreme Court building, demanding that the original sentence, the sentence of death penalty, be upheld. And the various Islamist movements have threatened to grind the country to a standstill if indeed that sentence is not upheld. And the great concern is that for the various members of the bench, their own lives could be threatened if indeed they acquit Asia Bibi, let alone the potential repercussions for Christians in Pakistan of an angry mob dissatisfied with the court's decision. So we're in a very, very difficult position because we know full well that the case against Asia Bibi is by no means proven. And indeed, we're all confident that she will in time be acquitted. And it adds to this sense of extraordinary injustice and extraordinary pain and hurt that there is this hope that she will be set free, and yet it's that day is never quite yet dawning, as yet at least.
What can people do, John?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to remember the words of Asia Bibi herself. She actually left a message for her daughter and for her daughter's father, the husband of Asia Bibi, Ashik, for them to take to the UK. And they came to the UK bearing this message from Asia Bibi, and she was very clear in what she had to say. She said, please pray for me and for my family, that we will indeed be reunited, that I will be set free. And then she said something very poignant, that she would be prepared to die rather than renounce her Christian faith. She wanted it to be made plain that under no circumstances would she yield to pressure to give up her Christian faith. And she is somebody who knows and lives the reality of what happens if you follow your faith. And she is, to that extent, a living martyr. And her courage, her faith, her example, her self-sacrifice sends out a signal to all of us that there is an urgent need to stand up for faith and freedom, and there is a need to place our faith in God and to remember that this is the one thing that matters before everything else, and that we should all be listening carefully to the example she sets.
John, thank you so much for that update on Asia Bibi, and we of course pray that there will be a favourable result for her. And as John said, it really is. It's just inspiring to think, and I suppose when you think of some of the things that you might grumble about, especially when it comes to your faith here in Ireland, and no comparison to it, actually it truly, truly inspires me to think of that woman, 8 years in prison, and she will not renounce her faith because she knows her Lord so well, and she won't turn her back on him. If you want to find out more about the work of ACN, by the way, you can go to their website, acn.org. Well, you might know that the second stage debate on the abortion legislation concluded last Thursday. Now, the first vote on the bill will take place in the Dáil today. After that, the bill will then go to committee stage. So what concerns are there at this point of the process? And did those who voted yes to this legislation know what was actually in the draft bill? Well, there's some of the things that we're going to be talking about with my next guest, Sinn Féin TD for Meath West, Padraig Tobin, joins me on the line. Morning, Padraig, how are you?
Good morning to you.
Well, talk to me a little bit just about what's been happening so far in terms of discussion in government about this legislation. What stage is it at and what's been happening?
Yeah, so first of all, obviously, I'm speaking on my own behalf. I'm not speaking on behalf of Sinn Féin. It's important to say that on this particular issue, because I have a divergent, different view from the party on that. Right now, obviously, the legislation is going through the Dáil, and legislation have five stages. The first stage is the second stage. I know that sounds a little bit complex, but the first stage that we get to debate on in the Dáil is actually the second stage. And currently, people have had their say in a general sense around the bill, and then there's a vote today around 2:30 or 3:00, and depending on that vote, it'll then possibly proceed to committee stage. And at committee stage, then TDs are entitled to make or to try and make amendments to the bill. After committee stage, now all of the committee, unfortunately, are pro-choice TDs, so it's unlikely that any of the committee stage amendments will actually be successful. But then it will move back into the Dáil for a report stage in which further amendments can be tabled, and that those votes on those amendments will be by the full Dáil. So there is an opportunity to get a motions and amendments through on that stage. And then finally, there is fifth stage where there's final speeches on it, and then there's a final vote. The truth of the matter is it's likely that this bill is going to be passed, and there may be some opportunities for amendments on it.
Has there been any discussions about that so far, Padraig, just in terms of TDs like yourself? Have you had a chance to voice your concerns or put forward amendments that you would like?
Yeah, the first major point that I've made, I suppose, in the Dáil is that 723,632 people voted no to this particular referendum. That's a bigger vote than the total Fine Gael vote. It's bigger than the total Fianna Fáil vote. It's a higher vote than the combined Sinn Féin, Labour, AAA, People Before Profit, Social Democrats and Green Party vote. It's a significant vote. And, you know, if you take that on an all-Ireland basis, there's probably about 1.3 million pro-life voters on the island of Ireland. And that's a significant minority. And minorities have a right to participate in the debate, and they have a right to be represented in Leinster House as well. And they shouldn't be censored. Another point that I've been making on this debate so far is the government and the media currently are trying to say that the referendum vote was really a vote for this particular bill. And some of the pro-life Fianna Fáil TDs have got sucked into this rubbish, to be honest. And the chair of the referendum commission, Justice Isabel Kennedy, stated very clearly before the referendum that legally the referendum vote was only about deleting the Eighth Amendment or not. And it did not include at all the legislation. And even Simon Harris beforehand said the actual vote was on the referendum and not the legislation at the time.
Since then, Padraig, Simon Harris has certainly changed his tune. He's basically made statements saying, you know, people knew exactly what was in the legislation. They knew what they were voting for. Do you think that's the case?
Well, absolutely not, because I've spoken to TDs in Leinster House and they still don't know what's in the legislation, many of them. Like, I've spoken to TDs who didn't know that the abortion is available up until birth in this particular bill, that abortion is available, you know, up until viability at 6 months when, you know, the unborn child is very formed at that stage. I had a nephew that was born at 24 weeks and is alive and well, thankfully, now, and that abortion is available at that age. You know, most people wouldn't know that, you know, abortion will be available at the age where the unborn child can feel pain. And most people wouldn't know that, you know, in other countries, that there are, you know, unborn children survive abortions, mostly in cases where they're severely injured and they're left to die. And what I'm looking to do is to make sure that we have an amendment in the legislation that if that does occur in Ireland, that those health care providers that are around actually intervene and save that unborn child's life. Most people wouldn't know that the legislation allows for gender selection abortion or abortion in the case of disability. And, you know, I've also spoken to people on the health committee who will be discussing this, and they were not aware that the legislation forces doctors to make arrangements for abortions to happen, even if they are conscientiously objecting to
and
the
that has been one of the big issues. I know there was an event outside the Dáil last week where people were kind of, and doctors and pharmacists, various different members of the medical profession were stating their concerns about conscientious objection, received very little coverage in the media. Is the Minister for Health listening on this particular issue, on that of conscientious objection?
There was a massive crowd at that protest. I was at it, and I don't think RTE covered it in any way whatsoever. And it's just, what's very dangerous with regards to media, in my view, is if the media don't allow for people who respectfully have difficulties with this, they're going to push many people to the edges of politics who become increasingly frustrated with regards that they're not being given a platform to articulate their views on this. And, you know, that's a real danger. And we've seen that in America and other countries. With regards to Simon Harris, Simon Harris seems to be sticking to his guns with regards forcing doctors to make arrangements for abortions. You know, if I made arrangements for your death, Wendy, I would be legally and morally culpable in that death. And, you know, for hundreds of doctors are going to really have a problem with, you know, making arrangements for the death of an unborn child. And there's also the issue of, you know, citizens who conscientiously object to abortions. You know, this is a key issue. There's a line in this piece of legislation that can't be hidden from. It's a really sobering line. And that line says that an abortion is an operation which ends the life of a fetus. And that's really sobering. And for citizens listening to this, many will be against that, but their tax money will be forcibly used to pay for those operations.
We don't have a choice on that.
No, there won't be a choice. Like, so in other words, the whole referendum is dressed up on this idea of choice, and yet choice ends because doctors don't have a choice on whether or not to participate. Citizens don't have a choice with regards to whether or not to fund these issues. TDs like myself seemingly don't have a choice on whether or not to vote against this issue in the Dáil. And think about it for a second, that, you know, we have 19 mothers who gave birth in emergency accommodation last year. The government doesn't have enough money for emergency scoliosis operations, and yet they want your tax money, 12 million of it, to pay for abortions that you oppose. And that's, you know, just, you know, abhorrent to many, many people. And, you know, there's another aspect to this, and whether or not, you know, people are voted for this legislation that I just want to touch on. RTE carried out an exit poll on the day of the referendum. Well over 3,500 people were polled. It's one of the most detailed poll carried out in the country. It'd be four times the size nearly of the polls that people read in their papers on the Sunday. And that said that, you know, 20% of people who voted yes in the referendum did not state that they agreed with abortion on request up until 12 weeks. So that's about 250,000 voters who voted yes, who don't agree with the contents of this legislation, and yes, they're being ignored as well. One of the problems here is that there's a large bulk of Fianna Fáil TDs who said that they were pro-life before the referendum who have gone to ground. And I would see Fianna Fáil currently as an inverted pyramid, where a small group of really ambitious TDs around Micheál Martin are telling the other TDs and Fianna Fáil members to get stuffed and to shut up on this issue. And that's wrong. These people need to come out and simply participate in the debate respectfully and vote according to their conscience.
So just finally to ask you, Peter Tobin, for people listening at the moment who hold a pro-life position and maybe feel just quite despondent about the whole thing and kind of feel it's a done deal, is there anything the average person can do?
Yeah, first and foremost, people can absolutely lobby their TDs at the moment. And there is a good deal of lobbying happening in this. And I know that some of those Fianna Fáil TDs that I mentioned earlier are coming under pressure on it. So pick up the phone, book a clinic meeting with your TD or your counsellor and say, you know, these issues around conscientious objection, around abortion in the case of female gender or disability, or in the cases around, you know, pain suffered by the unborn child. Make sure that the TDs know that that's inherent in this particular bill, and that they vote for amendments against the worst aspects of this particular bill. And also, just I will say, this debate doesn't end at this legislation. We will either go to a British situation where, you know, it may be buried for 20 years, or we'll go to an American situation where it's a political topic that is alive, and people, through time, get to shave off the worst excesses of the particular bill over time. And I would say for people is, you know, make sure that they don't disappear like the snow off a ditch on this issue. Make sure that they get absolutely politically active and function on this issue into the future, that this issue isn't lost into the future, and that people remain engaged with the campaign, because there's nothing more than the pro-choice lobby would like as people like ourselves to disengage, because that would literally give them license to deregulate abortion further in the future.
Paddy Tobin, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. I have to say, one thing that strikes me as we're chatting to TD Paddy Tobin there, just about generally, we need to think about whatever your position on abortion is, but we need to think about what we want in politics. Do we want people, do we want politicians who have a backbone, who have integrity, who will stick to their conscience? Or, as Paddy mentioned there, do we want politicians who just go to ground simply so they can stay in power? Well, I know what type of politician. If I said to you, how many teaspoons of sugar do you reckon you've had today? Would you have any idea? Okay, perhaps you might be able to count the one or two that you put into your tea or coffee this morning. But would you know, for example, if you had a yogurt, how much sugar was in that? Or, for example, if you had granola or something that you might think is healthy. You wouldn't think, you know, I've had a bar of chocolate or all that sort of stuff. Do you actually know how much sugar is the max intake that you're meant to have? And how do you quantify that? I think a lot of people don't. The thing is about Ireland is obesity, and indeed childhood obesity, is continuing to be a huge issue in Ireland. We're actually set, according to the World Health Organization, to be one of the fattest nations in the world. Certainly not a label that we should be proud of. Safe Food Ireland actually also found that the average Irish family spends 20% of its food budget on treats, so things that are full of sugar. The sugar tax that came in recently on sugar sweetened drinks, has that actually made an impact? I don't know. Well, if we're spending that amount of money, it's saying a lot. Well, in the studio, just to give us a little bit of advice, but also insight into how addicted to sugar I think many of us are, we have Ciara Rye. She's a registered nutritional therapist and director of Glenvale Nutrition. Ciara, good morning to you.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's talk about just the amount of sugar that we're meant to have each day, as in we don't need it, but the maximum recommendation.
Yeah, so this is free and added sugar, let's say. So it's not naturally occurring sugar that might be in something healthy like milk, for example. But added sugars is about 6 teaspoons a day for an adult woman and 9 teaspoons for an adult male. Kids, on the other hand, should only really have about 2 teaspoons. And you mentioned yogurts there for as an example. And that's where some of the research recently kind of exploded, because in any kind of a flavoured yogurt, so natural yogurt is fine. That's natural sugar. It's really good for you. It's got calcium and protein. That's actually really good for you. Any kind of a flavoured yogurt, almost none of them can be considered low sugar. So if you've given your kid a flavoured yogurt, a strawberry yogurt of any kind, they're probably over their maximum daily
just
limit.
Just from that one yogurt.
Just from that yogurt.
And then it can be deceptive as well. You know, when you see things that, for example, are the label will say low fat. They might be low fat, but they're loaded with sugar oftentimes.
Absolutely, because actually when you take fat out of a food, we all, our brains love fat. Our body is designed to like fat. So when you take a fat out of a food, it often doesn't taste as nice. So they tend to, and certainly historically, they've tended to put in a lot of sugar instead. So, and there's a lot of yogurts that would be marketed as healthier. You know, they're green and they might have flowers on them or whatever it is it's supposed
to
look.
And you think you're doing something good.
Of course you do. They might have like seeds or barley or something on the front of it that makes it look like it's supposed to be healthy. But actually, even in that study by the University of Leeds, the organic sugar or the organic yogurts, which again you might think are healthier, had some of the highest levels of sugar. So you literally can't tell by just looking at the front of the yogurt.
Is it all about reading the label? It's something I've become really aware of, especially having a small child, that you're even more concerned about salt and sugar and things like that. Although I will admit, extremely strict in the first few months, and then it kind of gets harder as the child gets older and is eating more. I remember picking up a packet again. I'm laughing to myself when you're saying something you think is healthy, and it was vegetable crisps. So it was beetroot and sweet potato and all these vegetables that I thought, wow, I'm being really healthy. They tasted amazing, so good that I thought they taste too good. And I looked at the back and there's a load of sugar in it, something I never would have thought would have had sugar. Salt maybe. In terms of our actual addiction to sugar, because it's in so much processed food that we eat, is everybody kind of a little bit addicted, you think, Ciara?
Possibly. Now, it depends on the flavour of something. So something really, if you can perceive it to be quite sweet, there's probably quite a lot of sugar in that. If it has a little bit of fat in it as well, your brain is going to really enjoy that. So I was talking before about something called the bliss point. So that's a really great combination of fat and sugar that your brain absolutely adores, and it releases reward chemicals in your brain. So you really, really enjoy it. You're really going to want more and more of it. And food companies put an awful lot of time and research into finding these bliss points in foods and designing foods that your brain is going to really enjoy and therefore want more and more of. So even though you thought it was just a bread or just a soup or whatever it was, if it has a nice combination of sugar and fat, you're going to want it more and more again and again.
Can you actually retrain your palate? Now, I'm thinking of, it can be the child or the adult that's been having those strawberry yogurts for years. Loves the taste, but is used to the sugar, and then says, okay, I'm going to switch to natural yogurt.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's something we do with our clients all the time, because people can't go from having a high sugar or high salt diet to a quote unquote perfect diet overnight. You could do that for about 5 days. You might be totally miserable and then you'd fall off the wagon and go completely back onto the habits. So a really good suggestion is to mix things. So for your child or even for yourself, keep buying your strawberry yogurt and buy a natural yogurt, mix them half and half, and then gradually mix out the strawberry yogurt so you're left with natural, and maybe chop up a few strawberries into it. And you absolutely can retrain your palate that way over a course of time, and kids might not even notice.
Is a lot of it psychological, Ciara, in terms of that? Say with things that we see as treats, although as we're talking about the sugar and things that you might necessarily deem as a treat, that we almost kind of condition ourselves into thinking, okay, every night when I sit down to watch Coronation Street or whatever with my cup of tea, I'll have my chocolate biscuit. And we almost, we're in so much of a habit, it's more of a habit than actually a desire a lot of the time.
Of course it is. We all have really busy, demanding lives, more so than ever now. So it's no surprise that we feel like, God, I really need to just sit down now, I've put the kids to bed, I've finished the laundry, I've done the work, I've finished those emails, I need some relaxation time. And you can absolutely associate that with the chocolate bar and the cup of tea. And again, it's about gradually changing that mental association. So a long time ago, we were talking just off air there about being pregnant, and I was trying to be really healthy. And again, I wanted to try and give up the evening treat, and I wanted to associate my evening with something positive. So instead, I used to make my room really dark. I lit loads of candles. I had a specific show that I watched. I got into my, you know, comfiest clothes, and I made that.
Sounds like that was your first pregnancy.
I made that my treat and psychological, and I had to switch to herbal tea and all sorts of things for health reasons.
So we're rewarding ourselves in the wrong way. So it's creating a new reward system.
Yeah. It's creating a new reward system, and a lot of people that have kind of addictions will have to make new habits. And it's the same as when we go out to celebrate. We often celebrate with alcohol, for example. So if you have a party or a funeral or anything, you'll always have alcohol associated with that. Well, if you're addicted to alcohol, you have to make a new association, and you can't be having your events, you know, circled around alcohol.
What sort of damage is having too much sugar doing to our bodies, Ciara?
Well, predominantly for the moment, I mean, obviously for kids as well, tooth decay is a massive issue. And those WHO recommendations are, some of them are based on tooth decay. But that aside, it's the obesity is the problem. And you mentioned their childhood obesity. 1 in 4 children now are overweight and obese, and that is rising. We haven't turned the tide on childhood obesity yet. And the problem is, when they're older, they're going to be much higher risk for type 2 diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's, types of cancer, and even the stresses and the strains of being really overweight. And maybe that will have an impact on their confidence, on their ability to run around with their friends, on this, will they be continuously in some kind of dieting, self-loathing cycle? We don't know.
Yo-yoing, yeah. Kind of, yeah. So what do we do when we are kind of, see, I think sometimes when things are kind of heading onto a path of destruction, and we're looking at those figures and we're saying it almost feels like we're so far gone, but we're not, are we?
Not at all. And I actually think Irish people are brilliant for getting on board with new changes. I think we give out at the start. So for example, when we brought in the plastic bag levy, everybody's like, oh, what a load of nonsense. But you're now, everybody brings their shopper to the shop.
Yes, and if I forget my reusable bag, it's like,
you
wasn't
your plastic bag. It's mad. And the smoking ban, we all thought that was ridiculous, but it's been hugely successful. And there's young people now are not starting smoking half as much as they used to when we were young. And I think with the sugar, I think it's just a change of attitude that's needed. So just that, okay, look, you know what? That's not acceptable. So, for example, I was at my daughter's GAA match. Now, I don't want to out my GAA club. They are incredible. The amount of time those mentors devote, you know, voluntarily is incredible. But there was an hour long game. There was 15 minutes, a little 15 minute matches. And then at the end, so between each match and at the end, and if you got like a player award, you got a giant fizzy jelly. So that could have been 5 or 6 giant fizzy jellies over the course of an hour.
And is that one of the issues that we're associating? And I think parents do it all the time. We associate reward, as we do for ourselves, if you touch on care, but with our children, rewards and treats, they always seem to be sugary things. You can have an ice cream if. Do we need to think of a new reward system for our children?
Definitely. That is definitely something you could do. Well, I make up things that we are probably have planned already for the weekend. So let's say I say to my husband, this weekend, let's go check out that new playground. I've heard there's one out in Sandymount or whatever. And then I'll gear my children towards that. I'll say, right, if you get your stars on the chart this week, you can choose the treat at the weekend. And the treat at the weekend is either we'll go to the beach at Bray or we'll go to this new playground in Sandymount. And then, I mean, I've already orchestrated and planned it out already, but they think that's their reward.
And you're getting time together and you're being active. So it's kind of win-win.
We were going to do it anyway. So, but now it's
one of the things I wanted to ask you about that I think, again, a lot of parents mightn't be, or I suppose we need to have our eyes open to, is even, and you've mentioned yogurts, right, that foods that are targeted at children of all ages, but even things like foods that are targeted at babies. So baby purees and all that sort of stuff. And they'll say organic on the label, but look closely. And a lot of those have a lot of sugar in them too, at a time when they should be having very, very little amounts of sugar. How vigilant do we need to be while also being practical? You know,
yes,
for a mum that's there going, actually, do you know what? I can't be pureeing carrots and all that sort of stuff.
Of course. Now, I will say most of those baby pouches won't have added sugar. So a lot of that sugar will just be coming naturally from fruit.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's not as bad. Now, we were talking about sugar taste and developing a taste there for sugar. So what you don't want to do is maybe feed your baby fruit flavoured pouches all the time. You want to make sure you're giving them some of the vegetable ones as well. Some of them that will say it's pear, pea and broccoli as a mix. And if you look at the back, it's like 80% pear.
No wonder they love it so much.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you can either find some that are more vegetable based, or, you know, mash up your own carrot and then squeeze in a bit of that extra pouch, so there's a little bit of balance there. So maybe veering more towards the vegetables if you can, and not going too much on the fruit, but to be clear that that's not added sugar. They're not adding in teaspoons of white sugar into the baby food.
Just want to get a final piece of advice off you, Ciara, this morning for people who are listening, saying, okay, look, I want to cut down on sugar for the whole family, for myself, for the kids. Where is a good starting point? I'm just like picturing people going into their houses, throwing all the sugary stuff in the bin, you know, and then maybe giving up a few days later because they've gone from one extreme to the other. Where is a good place to start?
Yeah, I think dairy is actually a really good place to start. And you mentioned they're reading food labels. I mean, you would literally be 2 hours in the supermarket if you read all of your food labels. So don't do that. Pick one food product that you think, actually, we eat this quite a lot. Maybe it's your yogurts. Maybe you go for some kind of dairy drink or dairy-based dessert for your kids. They can be really, really high in sugar. Or maybe it's a pasta sauce that you say, well, I use that pasta sauce at least 2 nights a week. I know it's the Tuesday and Wednesday dinner because we're rushing out to GAA or whatever it is. Have a look at that particular sauce or that particular dairy drink and just see if there's one change you can make. There's loads of different ones on the market. Or could you go for natural yogurt, for example, or wean in, as I was saying? Or could you look for a different pasta sauce that maybe has no added sugar? And then all you're doing is 2 nights a week, you've cut back on your sugar massively. So just taking one step at a time, don't go through your entire cupboard. You'd be there all day.
You'd be there all day and just start small. I like it. And then it's achievable. Really great advice today from Ciara Wright. I've been talking to Ciara as a registered nutritional therapist and director of Glenville Nutrition. And if you want to find out more about them or get in touch with Ciara, you can go to their website, which is glenvillenutrition.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.